Meeting of the Senate Finance Committee will please come to order. It's Friday, May 13th, 2011. And we're going to do just a little shift in the agenda. We're going to have Senator Carlson take his bill first on the State Employee Group Insurance Program, Senate File 849. Good afternoon, Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, I am State Senator John Carlson, Senate District 4, and I have Senate File 849 before you today, and I'll tell you a little reason why we're here in finance. We don't need to be here because I have the A1 author's amendment. So if somebody would be so kind as to move the amendment for me, please.
I'll move the amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Perry moves the A1 amendment. To like to explain it, please.
Yes, I would. Thank you, Madam Chair. What the amendment does is it takes out a provision of the Senate file that would have required CGIP to send certified notices to retired employees that their option of continuing their health insurance was ready to expire, and that had created a substantial fiscal note. And so we took that portion out of the bill. What it left in the bill was some language that would help out a retired conservation officer who is traveling and didn't get his mail, and so didn't get his premium paid on his health insurance. It's his money, he has to pay it. After repeated requests with MMB and the CGIP office, found out that there is no provision for these retired employees to pay their health insurance premiums either online or with a credit card on a monthly basis. Everything gets mailed out. And so if you can imagine, a conservation officer many times retires at age anywhere between 50 and 55, and younger than I am. And so I think I'm still in the prime of my life, and so they're out having some fun that they didn't get to have when they were working 18, 20 hours a day protecting our resources. And what happens is these people end up getting tied to their mailboxes because of an old archaic system of having to get a bill in the mail and having to turn around and write a check and mail it back. This retired employee of the state lost his health insurance coverage through CGIP. So what would remain on this bill, Madam Chair and members, would be some language that would allow this employee to get his CGIP back. He ought to pay back all his premiums. He understands that. He's happy to do that. But I guess what I'd like to do, it would be really nice, and I've talked with people at MMB, we really need to get some changes in that system. I hope this will be one step closer to getting that change, bringing that into the 21st century. With that, I'd stand for questions.
Okay. We're on the A1 amendment. Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, we obviously heard the bill in Senator Perry's committee, and it seemed to be okay. How does the amendment differ from what we heard in the committee?
What the amendment does, Madam Chair, and Senator Cohen, what the amendment does is it eliminates the section that would go further than just helping out the employee. The Second Amendment was a requirement for CGIP that they would have to send out by certified mail and get a written receipt back that the employee had actually received the mail before they could discontinue the coverage. Thank you for that question.
So as you can imagine, there are quite a few retired employees and their spouses, and so the fiscal note added up. So we're removing that and addressing this particular individual's problem, but hopefully calling attention to the need to find another payment system that would help the former employees as well. So Senator Perry has moved the A1 amendment. All in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Is there any more discussion on the bill?
I have nothing further, Madam Chair. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to try to answer them.
Anything else? Senator Cohen moves Senate File 849 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the floor. All in favor, signify. Oh, I should ask. Is there anyone in the audience who wanted to testify for or against the bill? Otherwise, we go back to the motion on Senate File 849. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The bill will be referred, will be placed on general orders.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Next up, we have Senator Hoffman's bill, Senate File 1357, Defense of Dwelling and Person Act of 2011. Welcome, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Glad to be here.
Senator Hoffman, would you like to explain your bill? As you know, this is the Finance Committee, so we don't need to go through it all with all of the policy provisions, but we do have a fiscal note on it that we need to address, and we do want a brief understanding of what this bill includes.
Sure, Madam Chair. Thank you. Senate File 1357 enacts the Castle Doctrine. Providing for the use of deadly force by an individual is justified. Here's my notes. Justified under this section when the act is undertaken, and then it lists some of the parts of the bill that strengthen our ability to stand our ground if we feel threatened. A licensed conceal and carry gun holder. The reason that we're before this committee today is. With some of the reporting provisions that we put in the bill, it generated some fiscal notes both with the Department of Health and with the courts. And so we have, I would like to offer the A8 amendment and see if we can rectify that.
Senator Perry will make that motion on the A8 amendment that will be distributed. Senator Hoffman, do you want to begin explaining what this is?
If I could, Madam Chair, I'd like to ask Chris Turner if he could join us at the table and he can explain the amendment and how it affects the fiscal note.
Mr. Turner.
Thank you again.
Madam Chair, members, Chris Turner with Senate Counsel and Research. The A8 amendment deletes three sections to the bill. Article 1, Section 1. Article 1, Section 2, and Article 1, Section 3. Section 1 requires the Department of Human Services to report all historical civil commitments, which means back to 1994, to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, or the NICS system, in electronic data format. Section 1, it has a biennial cost of $222,000. It turns out that that mining this historical data would be quite difficult for DHS, and that and the fact that it costs money, Senator Hoffman is suggesting that we return to current law, and that would take care of the $222,000 to DHS. Section 2 requires the courts to report criminal diversions and certain disqualifying gross misdemeanors to NICS. This has a one-time cost of $200,000, whether it's contracted or done in-house. Both of these requirements were an attempt to plug gaps in the NICS system, the federal background check system, that are there gaps on certain historical data and criminal diversion programs. And because of the difficulty of getting this information, the fiscal note showed a $422,000 cost. And finally, Section 5 is deleted, and Section 5 is connected to Section 1. It just requires an annual progress report to the legislature on the implementation of Section 1. That's A8.
Senator Cohen.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Turner, does this then reduce the fiscal note to zero?
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, yes.
Okay. And Madam Chair, if I can just inquire that on the amendment, maybe of Senator Hoffman. And this is the first time I've seen the bill, but if you're, the indication from Mr. Turner is that the additional reporting requirements were difficult to enforce or to or would cost a little bit of money. But why wouldn't we want to, and again, maybe it's taken care of elsewhere in statute, so just tell me if that's the case, why wouldn't we want to have some of the information, the background information provided to the background, the national system, and why wouldn't we want commitment information provided?
Senator Hoffman, do you want to answer that?
Madam Chair, what just deleting these sections, actually, we just revert back to what is already in statute, and much of that information is currently being provided. We are trying to do a historical providing and bring the state of Minnesota into the NICS system so that we could do better background checks on people. I've spoken to the courts, and because of the system, they're trying to implement it, and we're just going to work on it to see if we can't fill some of the gaps. So we won't be doing anything different now than we have been doing in the past. So the reporting will stay the same as it is already in statute.
Senator Goodwin.
So, Madam Chair, Senator Goffman, what you're saying then is that we're expanding the ability to shoot somebody, but we're not going to get more information on background checks on them before we allow them to get a permit?
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin, no, we're not expanding anybody's ability to shoot anybody. This is about a law-abiding citizen having a gun permit. What we're doing is we're going to revert back to the system that we're currently under. I don't believe that any other provision in this bill will cause law-abiding gun permit holders to go out and do anything different than we've already done. So,
the
police also testified in the House this week that the way our system works now, it works fine.
But, Madam Chair, we're expanding. We're greatly expanding the use of firearms or the ability to defend oneself over a fear that they might be hurt or something. We're definitely expanding the current law on the use of firearms and what's considered a felony or not a felony or, you know, and yet we're saying that we don't need any additional protections and background checks. I mean, you'd have to agree that your bill is expanding what's currently in law above and beyond anything that we have, and yet we're not expanding them. And we're also, and this doesn't take out the ability for what you're saying, that people can use permits from any other state, but yet we're not doing any extended background checks, correct?
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Goodwin, as I said, we're going to use what we already use in current statute to do background checks.
Well, Madam Chair, I can see that she's not going to answer my question, so let's just go on.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe we've completed our business here on the fiscal note, so I would move that Senate File 1357 be recommended to pass.
We are still on the amendment, Senator Perry. So we're still on the amendment.
I thought we moved the amendment.
You did move the amendment. We just haven't voted on it yet. Senator Cohen.
Well, Madam Chair, maybe I could just play say that. I don't know if Mr. Bodden could help. In terms of Section 2, is there anything similar then in statute? I suppose that'd be a question better directed to Mr. Backus. But.
Mr. Turner might be able to help, too. Or is Mr. Backus here? Mr. Turner?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Cohen. If I understand your question right, there is a provision in law that's similar to Section 2. 2 years ago, the legislature passed the requirement that the courts report all people civilly committed, whether mentally ill, developmentally disabled, mentally ill and dangerous, chemically dependent, or sexually dangerous, to the NICS system. In that respect, for current data, Section 1 is actually redundant. But that went into effect in 2009. It's the only requirement so far for that the courts report directly to NICS. Section 2 would be an expansion of the court obligation to report to that system.
Any other questions on the A1 amendment? Senator Higgins?
Not on the amendment.
Senator Latz, I did ask if he could make a comment briefly on this amendment, and I did say that he could. I know it's a bit unusual, but if we could just let him say a few words before we take a vote on the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate your allowing me to speak. I'm the one who raised the objection on the Senate floor to this matter being heard with the fiscal note attached to it, and I thought I'd share my thoughts on it. I heard this bill extensively in the Judiciary Committee as well, where we first raised the question relating to the fiscal note. And I think this committee needs to consider the policy question, since it's in front of you. It should have been in front of some other committees for this policy question. But whether or not it's appropriate to delete an important provision in this bill, even though it carries a fiscal note. You've already heard the reasons why those provisions are in the bill. It's because there are gaps in the reporting system right now relating to the mental health status, the commitment status, the disability status of individuals, and the databases don't have that information. Presently, the Commissioner of Human Services is not required to report the commitment information to the national database. Yet, under state law, the Chief of Police and the Sheriff shall check the criminal histories through the national database. So you've got a national database that is deficient with regard to Minnesota information on individuals that might be mentally incapable of safely having a firearm in their possession. Certainly would be disqualified from having a permit. So the reason for having Section 1 in the bill is to fill those gaps, to require the Commissioner of Human Services to report the information to the national database, and separately and independently to make available in an electronic data format that commitment information, the historical information. So it doesn't say that that has to be made through the national database. That would be a separately electronically available database available through the Commissioner of Human Services. And that contains that historical information. That information is not gathered anywhere right now. It's basically invisible in the aggregate to any sheriff or chief of police that's making a permitting decision. So there's a lot of information out there about people who have these mental health issues that will never be found out by a chief or sheriff when they're doing a background check for a permit. And whether you agree with the policy provisions about expanding the acceptable use of firearms or not, the holes in that information that's available for the background checks ought to be troubling to everyone. And these provisions in the bill are designed to fill those holes. Same with Section 2. And I think maybe Mr. Turner misspoke when he said Section 3 was targeted for deletion of the amendment. I think it's Section 5, the reporting requirement. That reporting requirement also means the legislature will not get an annual report to determine the status of these database requirements. I should note for your consideration that the Department of Human Services didn't even start reporting the mental health information to until August of 2010. So there are a lot of gaps here. So it would be better public policy for the state of Minnesota to find the money to fund filling these database gaps, especially when it's an important part of this bill, than it would be to simply delete the offending provisions because there's not the political will to find the funds to make it safer to issue the permits. And that's why I'd urge you to reject the amendment and instead to find the funds to provide for this database management.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Senator Latz, for bringing that information, and now the discussion will be among the members on the committee. So, Senator Bonna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With regard to the amendment, you know, I'm going to oppose the overall bill, but in terms of this amendment, should this overall bill go forward, I think Senator Latz makes some good points. I myself have been a victim of somebody who threatened my life who had mental health issues. And I don't talk about it because, you know, it's not something you like to talk about. But I sat here listening to that and I thought, you know, victims, many of us at different points of our lives have been victims or we've had members of our family or people we know. And it is important to speak out and for people to have to confront that. You know, you can say, well, it's too expensive, we're in a fiscal crisis, but what is a life worth? You know, $331,000 if you've got a person with a mental health issue who has a firearm and the public doesn't know about it, that's a serious breach in our information. And so, yeah, I understand it is costly, but I think we would be negligent in this committee to not make sure that we do everything we can so that there aren't gaps in information. I think we owe the public that.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, maybe I could ask Senator Hoffman if you have any disagreement with how Senator Latz phrased his description of what's in the amendment.
Senator Hoffman.
You know, I'm going to ask if I can have Mr. Olson testify to some. He's got some historical information that I think Senator Latz may have looked over, and I think that Senator or Mr. Olson could help us with that.
Mr. Olson, please identify yourself.
Madam Chairman, Senator Cohen, my name is Joseph Olson. I'm a professor of law at Hamline University. I'm obviously not here on their behalf. I'm also president of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance, and I have been a registered lobbyist here on firearms issues for 25 years. If you will note in Section 1, the time period goes back to August 1st, 1994. The reason it goes back to August 1st, 1994 is because the basic section was effective on August 1st, 1994. And since that date, the Department of Health and Human Services has been required to provide information by electronic means. And if they had done what they were required to do since 1994, we would have all that information readily available. And easily transferable from the computer database at the Department of Human Services to the NICS database. I heard testimony with regard to this section in the House by a number of police chiefs to the effect that they could get the information, but the problem was the Department of Health and Human Services. They didn't get it electronically, as the statute has required for 16 or 17 years. They had to send fax messages to the department. They had to wait 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks for the department to get back to them. All the while, the police chiefs were missing the statutory deadline that they faced. You know, this is a problem that needs to be solved. What this provision in Subdivision 1 attempts to do is simply say to HHS, do what you've been required to do all these years. And it's my understanding that they've gotten money for this all these years, and yet there is no electronic database available since 1974. So that provision, I think, should have no costs because it's something the agency is already required to do. With regard to Section 2, the pretrial diversion data, I talked to a high-ranking deputy at the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, and I was told, oh, there's no problem. That information is already in the MNSA system as a disposition. Now, it turns out that what's in the MNSA system is that someone goes on pretrial diversion. Nobody bothers to ever report when they either come off of it successfully or when they come off of it to be charged with a crime. That data is in the hands of the county attorneys for certain because they run the program. They determine who they're going to drop the charges against, and they determine who they're going to continue to take to trial. Maybe what we need to do in Section 2 is say the courts, with the cooperation of the county attorney, shall do this. And since the information is readily available, I have trouble as a non-legislator, non-financial expert, figuring out how they can spend so much money to do something that I can do on my home computer. The same thing with the gross misdemeanors. They're already in the data system. It's simply a matter of having the Mensa system communicate with the NICS system. I heard testimony in the House on an earlier bill to the effect that both of these pieces of information were available to Minnesota police chiefs and sheriffs, but they weren't readily available. That, you know, they had difficulty getting the information, but it is out there. So what this language does is provide that it shall be simply linked. The existing information shall be linked to the NICS system. Once again, I can't understand where these hundreds of thousands of dollars come from to do a task that is either has been long required or is currently being done.
Senator Cohen.
Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, Professor Olson, your testimony begs a couple of questions. First of all, if I might, I don't want to quibble in terms of the definition of a pretrial diversion program, but the county attorney would have nothing to do with it once somebody's placed in the program. The county attorney or a city attorney would consent to the placement of a first-time offender, as an example, into a pretrial diversion program. But as to whether or not there's a successful completion, the county attorney could make a recommendation back to the court, but the sentencing court, you know, the judge that has jurisdiction is the person who would determine if that individual had successfully completed the program. But it sounds like if there is a gap, shouldn't we try to do what we can to provide in statute the language that would ensure the gap doesn't exist? Now, that's a separate question from the fiscal note, because your other question raises concerns about why do we have this cost. Well, I mean, this committee could certainly indicate that we don't need the money for this and just keep the language, if that's a concern. I certainly know, Madam Chair, and you've run into this both chairing this committee and over the years, but, you put any kind of a responsibility on the agencies and, you know, they show up at your door saying we need, $75,000 to do this. So that may or may not be a point. I see that all the time. I've seen that all the time with the court system. But if this is, in fact, a gap in the system, and this language would help close that gap, then I'm not sure why we'd get rid of the language. Let's keep the language and not appropriate the money. Just direct the agency to do it.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. With regards to Senator Latz's testimony that this is going to loosen by not having these sections, and you're going to loosen it up. If you look in Subdivision 2, Section 3, Subdivision 2, there's already an area there that gives the police chief or the sheriff the opportunity to do all what we're talking about. And I think that's why the bill can continue to move through. I mean, it's already in law. They shall make a reasonable effort to check all of those particular areas. So, once again, we're trying our darndest to derail something here for the good folks in the state that want to protect themselves against those who could care less about going to the local sheriff to get a permit before they rob a bank or hold you up at home. I mean, I can't understand what we're doing here. I don't understand anybody that would not want their citizens the opportunity to protect themselves. I don't get it. Yeah, there's a reasonable way of checking here, and it's been going on for, oh goodness, many years now.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just feel like we're going down the wrong path. We're not really talking about what we're here to do, and that's a fiscal note, but that's your decision. But I do want to say one thing. And I'm starting to see a pattern here. When we, many of us, have said there's not enough oversight, in the last couple of finance meetings that we've had, I heard that for 10 years, the DNR didn't do their job. And now today I'm told that we can check, and for 17 years, Health and Human Services hasn't been doing their job with monies and direction given by the legislature. So this is what I'm taking out of the last two committee meetings, what I'm hearing. So when we say there needs to be better oversight and better scrutiny of some of these departments, we just had it proved to us again. This could have been alleviated had they been doing what they were told to do, as it's been explained today, and the money was appropriated to do it. So the question I would have is, where did that money go if they didn't do what they were directed to do?
Senator Berglund.
Well, Madam Chair, the Department of Human Services, state-operated services hospitals, do not have electronic medical records. You know, and, you know, it would be nice if they did, but they don't. And they don't have the money to do that. And I don't know if the Supreme Court can absorb things right now without funding, but I know the Department of Human Services can't. So I expect what happened is that this provision was placed in the law. I don't believe there was money appropriated to implement it, because if there had been, they'd have electronic records. And so they haven't implemented it because there was never any money provided. And if we eliminate the money now but keep the provision, they won't implement that either. I mean, you can tell a department to do things all day long if you want to, but if you don't provide the resources to do it, they are not obliged to do it just because it's in the law. So I, you know, while it might be nice to have these sections in the law, I don't see how we keep a section in the law that we can't fund. The Department of Human Services has nothing to say about whether they receive somebody. It is the courts that decide if somebody is going to be committed. So the courts know who's committed. Maybe the courts should be the one providing the information in the first place rather than the Department of Human Services.
Well, and I think the purpose of the amendment is to take out the section that would have put in a new requirement, an additional requirement that also required additional funding. There is a current requirement, as Senator Ingebertson pointed out, in Section 3. And so that remains. And so we still have a system to look back into, but this would have potentially enhanced that system. Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, my concern is, I mean, we have a couple of different strains of thought going on. Senator Ingebertson made the argument that, you know, we shouldn't stand in the way of citizens having access to what's contained in the bulk of the bill. We're talking about the amendment right now, and we can get into that discussion in a couple of minutes. But we have, say, the differences between, I'll suggest, Senator Perry and Senator Berglund, and I have sympathy with both. Senator Perry is suggesting why they should be doing this right now. Why do they need the money? Senator Berglund says, don't be so sure that there's the ability to comply with the present statute absent some additional funding. But nobody's really answered the question of why we would do away with what's in the statute. We're hearing Professor Olson suggested there's a bit of a gap. Senator Latz suggested that there's a gap. If there's a gap, why would we do away with this language? And I have not heard the argument as to why that would be the case. So it seems to me to err on the side of safety in terms of making sure folks, nobody at this table wants to see get access to firearms, that we should simply defeat the amendment. It's a relatively small cost, and then go on to what is the thrust and bulk of the bill as I understand it.
Senator Bonnef.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I think it's a pretty weak statement to say the chief of police or sheriff may also make a reasonable effort to check other available state and local record-keeping systems. I don't think I'd want to hang my hat on people's safety that we say you should make a reasonable effort and you may make a we actually cross out shall and say may. So I don't think that addresses the gap that we have acknowledged exists, and I would encourage the members to do what Senator Cohn says and defeat the amendment and then move on to the bill.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I happen to come from the world that really do care about who's carrying guns and who's going to have the permits to carry. And I know that the chiefs and sheriffs are willing to make that reasonable effort because it is a public safety issue. But as Senator Cohn has mentioned, in the interest of safety, I'm still not convinced that having the ability to protect yourself isn't a good thing. I'm just not hearing that a whole bunch of people are getting shot out there, that we have to restrict the good people as much as we can when the bad guys don't have to carry any restrictions. I don't understand where the safety issue comes from, Senator Cohn.
Senator Cohn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, I'm not talking about the thrust of the bill, although obviously I've got questions about that. Unfortunately, and this is not to fault Senator Hoffman, but I think this is, you know, once in a while we get into a problem like this. Because we've been talking around this. We really don't have the people here who could, I believe, offer us the direct testimony as to what's going on or not. We don't have people from Human Services. We don't have people from the Supreme Court. And I don't know what discussion took place in the Judiciary Committee or any other committee where this bill has been heard. But now we're in the Finance Committee and we're faced with an amendment where I think some questions have been raised as to why we should proceed with it. And again, Senator Ingebrigtsen, that's not to suggest that there might not be some reasons for passage of the entirety of the bill, but at least relative to the A8 amendment. We're talking around, going around in circles a little bit because we don't have the people present who can offer the detailed testimony relative to the amendment itself.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, members, again, this is not about, this discussion at this point isn't about not allowing people to carry firearms to protect themselves. This is about the amendment and making certain that that information gets to the National Instant Criminal Background Check. And with your comment saying, oh, people aren't getting hurt out there, there was actually a woman who was killed in the government center just a few years ago, and she was killed because somebody who had a mental health issue shot her. So I don't know whether or not having this would have helped, but, you know, but I think people with mental health issues, we want to make very careful, beyond a reasonable doubt, that they are not possessing firearms. It's a very serious and real issue, and there's no harm in making sure that that's in the bill.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we're talking about, in one hand, I'm not supposed to go into the weeds about what the whole bill is about, but it keeps going back there. And that's my whole point. The whole point is we can still, the function can still go on without what we're having here. So let's talk about the amendment. Amendment is we don't have apparently the finances to do that, so let's stay focused on that. Let's not talk about whether Senator Goodwin is saying that we are now going to license everybody to go out and shoot people. I didn't go into the weeds to start with. That's my whole complaint here.
The amendment focuses on whether or not we will be funding the NICS data system, the data that needs to be mined to be entered into that system so that it fills the gaps where the Human Services Department perhaps has not been doing for recent years, and we would be picking that up and doing that, completing that system. Senator Cohn.
And Madam Chair, just finally, again, I think part of the awkwardness we have with this amendment is we don't have the folks who could really offer us the detailed information on what the necessity might be. So obviously the Judiciary Committee felt this language should remain in the bill, where they would have had, I assume, a broader range of people to testify. You know, just to follow up on Senator Bonham's comment, and again, to reiterate what I had said, that well, we're not quite sure what we're doing in this instance. We should certainly err on the side of safety. Senator Bonham made a reference to somebody in the government center. Let's take something more recent, obviously not in Minnesota, but the shooting in Arizona. I mean, that was somebody who I don't think anybody at this table or in this room would suggest ought to have had access to firearms. Now, we don't know what the laws are in the state of Arizona, but certainly for Minnesota citizens, if this will close a couple of gaps in the reporting system at a moderate cost, I know there's money at the bottom line, I believe, and again, I realize, Madam Chair, you're in the process of completing conference committee reports, so I'm not sure where bottom line money is, but this is, I'm assuming there'll still be some money to do this.
Well, Senator Cohen and members, I think what we have to remember is that they have been issuing the concealed permit carry permits under the current system, and this has been going on for a number of years already, and so this would have changed that a little bit, but we have a system in place now that will continue even without this, and that's what's really at issue here. Your confidence in that system, whether or not that has proven effective, and I would dare say in Minnesota, we have not seen cases where people with concealed carry permits have caused any extensive amount of trouble in our society here, and so that's the question, is whether or not we feel the current system is adequate. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the points that you just made, you know, I think that you have very accurately stated what we should be dealing with and what we should be dwelling on. I frankly am not willing at all to simply accept the fact that DHS has not fulfilled their statutory obligation. Mr. Olson has, in effect, made an allegation, but we have no proof of that. And I respectfully disagree with Senator Berglund when she says just because DHS is told to do something that they're not obligated to do it. I think that they are, and if they're not going to, I would have thought that after, 17 years, they would have at least come back to us and say, hey, we can't do this. They would have tipped us off in some way. So I am now under the assumption that they are doing what they are supposed to do, and all Senator Hoffman is doing with her amendment is going back to the existing system that has been working for many, many years. And if I may, Madam Chair, ask Mr. Turner a question. Under Section 3, we do have the deletion that Senator Bonoff pointed out where we went from shall to may. If we reinstate the word shall, mandatory, will that change any fiscal implication?
Mr. Hoffman. Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, not to the state, I don't think so, because it's existing systems. It'd be MNCIS, be the Minnesota Criminal Information System. I don't think so. I would like to point out, however, that Minnesota Statute 253B.24 requires the Supreme Court to report directly to NICS all commitment information from Minnesota, and that includes people not just committed to state facilities but to county facilities and private facilities. So civil commitments are being reported to NICS directly by the Supreme Court, which has a larger database than the Department of Human Services, because Human Services only has access to people committed to them. There is a reporting requirement to the counties, but we don't know how accurate that is. The Supreme Court is the proper reporting agency, in my opinion, for this information.
Senator Bono.
Madam Chair, well, that information makes me feel much better about not having it, but I remain curious as to why the Judiciary Committee felt as though it should be included. And so Senator Hoffman, perhaps you could enlighten us, as you were at the table and heard the discussion. Why did the Judiciary Committee think that this was important? And as to the suggestion of the turning the reinstating the stricken language on line 2.33, I would offer as an oral amendment that motion to reinstate the stricken language.
Senator Bonoff, could you hold on that motion?
Oh, sure.
We need to deal with the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Is there more discussion on the A1 amendment? If not,
Madam
Senator.
Chair.
I asked a question.
Senator Cohen?
We're on the amendment.
On the A1 amendment.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I asked Senator Hoffman a question about why the judiciary felt it should be included.
Oh, I'm sorry. The A8. But then you were making a motion, so
I
was sidetracked, too. Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, Senator Bonoff, it's an existing law. And so the judiciary, and I can't speak for the whole committee, they voted it out based on all the testimony they heard. I know that I'm on the committee, and I also voted for it. It's in existing statute, and we are trying to direct the departments to do what they've been directed to do in statute already. So that's, I'm assuming that's why the rest of the members voted for it. I can't speak for them, but that's why I voted for it, because I want the departments to do what they're statutorily required to do, and that's what our body is supposed to be doing. We legislate, and they carry out the statute. And if I could, Madam Chair, I want to just correct something in Section 3 under the investigation part. The section does tell the chief of police. It says the chief of police or sheriff shall check in the first on line 2.3, shall check criminal histories, records. The amended language is just giving the sheriffs and the chief of police the option to check other databases or any other place they want to go look for the data that they might need to issue the permit. They're already directed to check the criminal histories of applicants. So the amended language there doesn't change what the law enforcement agencies are required to do to issue a permit. So I just wanted to clarify that that Senator Bonoff had brought up before.
That is a good clarification, because it does say they have to check three different information systems: the Minnesota Crime Information System, the National Criminal Record Repository, and the National Instant Criminal Background Check System.
Okay.
And then, but we're not really supposed to be on this part of it yet.
Okay.
But if it helps people vote on the A1 amendment, it's useful information to have. Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, you know, before we started the committee, Senator Perry indicated that. Senator Perry, I hope I'm not putting words in your mouth, that you were quite disappointed that I had not been jumping into things recently. And so in an effort to...
I didn't mean to start today, Senator Cohen.
I thought tomorrow would be a good time.
So, Madam Chair, in an effort to please Senator Perry, I jumped into this amendment. So I've been thinking, look, I've made the points, but... But, Madam Chair and Senator Hoffman, your last comment kind of begs the question. Okay, so in the Judiciary Committee, they had this language, and everybody voted for it. So who's requested
everybody.
This language between the Judiciary Committee and this committee? Where did this language come from for the amendment?
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen. You're talking about the language of my amendment?
Yes.
Or the bill?
No. The A8 amendment. If everybody in the Judiciary Committee thought this language as in the present bill was fine, and you indicated you supported it, I'm curious to know who objected to the language between the Judiciary Committee and here. Because we haven't heard from Human Services, we haven't heard from the Supreme Court, we haven't heard from law enforcement. I'm curious to know who's looking to pass this language? If Senator Hoffman, you came up with this on your own, or staff suggested it to you? I'm curious as to where it came from.
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, if you recall the House or the floor session the other day, Senator Latz is actually who pulled the bill back because of the fiscal note. And so in working with staff, and we looked at the current statute, we decided that the fiscal note... And then the fiscal notes came in late. So because of the fiscal notes, we're going to remove the strengthening language. I would love to keep the language in. I agree with you, Senator Cohen. But our current statute covers the background checks that we have been doing, and it's been working fine. I would love to strengthen it. the departments are telling me it's going to cost, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. I'm questioning that fiscal note, as we've been questioning them all through the session. And so we just decided on our own to take that language out because it seemed to be giving the departments so much heartburn. Our background checks have been working. I'm a conceal and carry permit holder, and I didn't have any trouble getting a permit, and I don't know anybody else that does.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, if you like the language, but for the money, we can take care of that. Easily enough. And I should point out that $200,000 to the Supreme Court is one-time money. The ongoing expense is $91,000, according to the fiscal note. So the ongoing cost is relatively small in the comparative scheme of things. So that's why, Madam Chair, I didn't think we'd have this kind of discussion on what appeared to be a simple amendment, but I'm just hearing this debate go all over the place. Senator Hoffman says, well, she likes the language, but not the money. Somebody else doesn't like the language, thinks it goes. So, I would, as I've said before, err on the side of safety and defeat the amendment. And, Madam Chair, I normally don't do this in committee, but I'm asking for a roll call on this.
Mr. Turner.
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, perhaps I can shed some light on this. When the bill came to the Judiciary Committee, only five of the six agencies had reported. The fiscal note was a preliminary note. The only cost that was listed was the cost to DHS. There was discussion in the committee about the requirement of DHS for the past 16 years to keep or tabulate historical commitment information. And that was why the bill was allowed to leave Judiciary. The day after it was voted out of Judiciary, the courts came in with their estimate. I had talked about this with the courts earlier, and they said there may be a problem with the diversion information that could be solved with a delayed effective date. They did not tell us that there was going to be a cost to the courts. After the bill passed our committee, the completed fiscal note came out, and there was a $200,000 cost to the courts. So we didn't know about Section 2. We thought that the reporting of gross misdemeanors wouldn't be a problem for the courts. We thought the only problem might be the diversion information. When we got the fiscal note and it said $200,000, it was probably a good thing that Senator Latz pulled it into the Finance Committee.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, so now we have Mr. Turner saying, and had done this a little bit earlier, that maybe the deletion of Section 1 might not be necessary. But then we have Mr. Turner suggesting Section 2 sounds like it's necessary.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, if we're going to have a roll call vote on this, then I'd like to have the amendment divided so that we vote on Section 2 separately. The deletion of Section 2. The other two sections deal with the Department of Human Services, so we'd be voting on them separately.
Okay.
And I would just point out to the members that the fiscal note itself says the court, not DHS, has a comprehensive data set of commitment information. So why would we want to spend money on something that's not even going to be complete?
And Madam Chair, that might be worth considering that. I would withdraw the request for the roll call based on Senator Berglund's division and then reinstate it for the rest of the amendment.
Senator Perry has made the original motion, so he would get to decide. So we would be, if we wanted to eliminate DHS only, it would be line 1.2 and 1.4. And so you would like to vote on that first, whether or not we should delete sections 1 and section 5. So, Senator Perry, which one would you like to vote on first? Deleting section 2 or deleting section 1 and 5?
I'd just soon vote on the motion that I have in front of this committee, Madam Chair.
It's not how I've asked right for a division.
It's divisible.
It is divisible. So You made the motion. You get to decide which part we vote on first.
That's the only option.
What were my options again, Madam Chair?
We would be voting on deleting sections 1 and 5 if we went with the eliminating the DHS portions of it.
Section 1.
Let me just check with some
one
council.
1 and 5 go together, and section 2 is going to be voted on separately.
That's the judiciary.
I don't understand.
Okay, so Senator Perry would like to take up Section 1 and 5 first.
That's the section with DHS?
That's correct.
Let's do that one first.
Okay. Well,
Madam Chair, could we have the author's?
Senator Hoffman, response to that? On that motion.
Madam Chair, I am supporting deleting those sections. That's why I asked for the division.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I'm fine with that. I'll consider that a friendly amendment.
Okay. All in favor of deleting sections 1 and 5 signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Okay. The motion does prevail. That amendment is adopted. Now we have the second half of that amendment, which is to delete section 2, which relates more to the courts. So, are we ready to vote on that as well? So all...
Roll call.
Oh, Senator Cohen has requested a roll call on this section.
Senator Berglund?
No.
Senator Bonhoff?
No.
Senator Cohen?
No.
Senator Fischbach?
Yes.
Senator Goodwin?
No.
Senator Hahn? Senator Higgins?
No.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes.
Senator Langseth?
No.
Senator Magnus?
Yes.
Senator Newman?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Perry?
Yes.
Senator Roebling?
Yes. On a vote of 7-6, the motion does prevail and the amendment is adopted. So now, members, we've dealt with the fiscal impact of the bill. Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, who wrote this bill for you?
Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, this was a bill that I worked on with the NRA and the gun owners. It was a joint effort.
Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, it's real clear that nobody in our legal office had much to do with the writing of this bill. In a quick scan, I see 5 sentences that don't even have periods at the end. I see random punctuation stuck here and there in middle sentences and other places where punctuation's missing. I see a sentence that the definitions are just bizarre. Vehicle means a conveyance of any type. Well, you know, one of the first definitions when you look up conveyance is a written document that transfers some sort of property from somebody to somebody else. Then what does that got to do with a vehicle? I don't know. Good faith has a definition that I've never seen, and after being in judiciary for about 4 years, excuse me, let me finish, please.
Senator Higgins?
It's just bizarre, and it's badly written. I mean, I think they're getting their point across what they want to do. I'm totally befuddled on the last page where the article says that we're going to recognize other states' permits to carry, but the last paragraph seems to say a resident of Minnesota isn't authorized to carry a pistol in Minnesota under the terms of a carry permit from another state. So,
point of order, Madam Chair.
Senator Perry.
Why are we dealing with policy? We're dealing on the fiscal note, and I believe we've taken care of that. I would like to move this bill.
Senator Perry, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
The Chair has, for many bills that have been through this committee this year, allowed us to talk about the policy that's involved. I haven't seen this in any committee that I serve on this year. And it has been allowed in every other instance where people wanted to talk about the policy. So now if today you decide you want to do something otherwise, I'm not sure why we would change our ways of doing things at this point. I think what I just brought up are some seriously legitimate questions. I think this bill is badly written. It needs to go back and have somebody go through it from our own staff using the language that we use in Minnesota, not the NRA from other states, and somebody make some sense out of it. I'm done now.
Well, Senator Higgins, I'm sure Senator Hoffman will look at it. She would want it to become part of statute in the correct form if it does indeed pass.
There's one there.
The reviser probably did have one. The reviser obviously saw this and put it into a bill format for us. But if there needs to be some additional work, we'll have our Senate counsel look at it too and see if we can make any corrections that might be necessary. Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair, being that the police department in my city is against this bill, I'd like to be recorded as voting no, so I'd ask for a roll call vote.
Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair, it's not my intent to get into a lengthy debate, but just a response to Senator Perry that historically over the years, not just this year's session, you know, the Finance and the Tax Committees, as the committees of last jurisdiction, have had discussions of policy issues when the bills come in front of them. You know, you try to focus on the fiscal issues, but we've never stopped discussion of the policy issues. I just want to inquire of the author, and you know, I opposed the conceal and carry bill, which we had when? Was that 2003, I believe?
Mm-hmm.
And but I understand why people sought it. Again, I voted no, but I understand that law-abiding citizens in Minnesota felt that there should be the ability to carry a handgun for whatever purpose. Again, I voted no, but I understand the rationale. This one, however, seems to be a bit of a stretch, and I'm having difficulty understanding the rationale behind this bill and what this will accomplish as opposed to present statute. The second thing, Madam Chair, I don't know if you have anybody who has requested to testify on the bill or not.
Just Professor Olson.
Okay. I'm going to request that Mr. Flaherty offer some testimony. Just get on the record in this committee for a couple minutes, if that's okay with Mr. Flaherty. But I present the question to Senator Hoffman as to what the rationale of this bill is as to present law.
Excuse, could you repeat that? The door was open.
Madam Chair and Senator Hoffman, what is the rationale of this bill as opposed to what is current law right now in Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Senator Cohen, first of all, I am a firm believer in my right as a law-abiding citizen to defend myself. And if I happen to be not in my home proper, but out in my yard or in one of my outbuildings or in my car, I still feel that I have the right to defend myself as a law-abiding citizen against criminals. And currently, the way the law is written now, we have the duty to retreat. And I don't think as a law-abiding citizen going around my community doing nothing wrong and being accosted by a criminal, I should have to turn my back on him and run. Clearly, at 54 years of age, I'm not going to outrun a 21-year-old. So this is the main reason that I brought this bill, is to strengthen my right to defend myself and to defend my family and for other people to defend themselves and to defend their families. This is something that many of my constituents have asked me for, and I told them that if I got elected, I would be sure to bring it for them. And so that's why I brought it. There's other provisions in the bill that I also think that need to be strengthened. We have a Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, and that right shall not be infringed. And the rest of the provisions in this bill, whether it be in a disaster declaration or anything else, is within our right to do, and that's why I brought this bill. I also was informed that we had some gaps in our reporting system. And I know that we want to keep people safe in Minnesota. We don't want people that aren't supposed to have guns. And so I thought I would try and fill some of those gaps. And then we got those outlandish fiscal notes, which we've been getting all year. And I discounted it in judiciary. I talked to the courts. They weren't going to oppose the bill. They were going to help me work on the bill so that we could get the date fixed so they could report. And then after we passed it out of judiciary, we got a fiscal note from the court. So, again, I'm going to question the fiscal notes. So we got rid of the fiscal notes. We're going back to what's in statute. I don't believe that since the last conceal and carry law was passed, or the first conceal, that we've had blood in the streets. And so I believe that this law won't change, that we won't have gun-yielding Wild West citizens running around shooting people. I just don't think that's going to happen. But I do vehemently defend my right to carry a gun and defend myself against a criminal.
Madam Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Madam Chair, I believe I've had an A rating from the NRA ever since I've been here for 36 years. And I do believe in the right to bear arms and all that. I voted for the concealed carry. I thought that was allowing law-abiding citizens to carry. But I think this one's going too far. We had a situation in our area where a young guy, I think he was around 21 years old, was drunk. He opened the wrong apartment door. A guy accosted him with a gun and shot and killed him. Now, that guy was sent to court. He got off totally free. So I don't see what is need for this when you have a situation like that where there wasn't the guy coming into his apartment wasn't even armed. He shoots and kills him, and he still doesn't get any kind of a penalty. So I really think in some ways this is encouraging that sort of thing. And you know, I understand why that guy panicked and shot him. But, boy, it sure seems to me that this is probably encouraging that sort of thing too much. And so if this is the first time I've voted against the NRA in 36 years, well, I suppose maybe I'll do that. But as far as this committee is concerned, we need to know what's in a bill because we want to know whether we're going to vote for it or not. I don't vote for or against a bill just based upon the fiscal note. It's the content of a bill. So, I'm going to get NRA's wrath, and that's fine. But I'm going to vote against this bill because I just think it's one step too far. And I still defend I got a lot of grief about the conceal and carry, but I think there's some statistics that showed that in the last 40 years, there's only been one murder committed by a person who had concealed and carry. So I think that really is dealing with the law-abiding citizens' right to defend themselves. But I'm just afraid this one is kind of encouraging people to... That fella that shot that young guy and killed him, I don't think should have done that. I think maybe at some point it made some sense, but I don't think he should have shot and killed him. And I'm just afraid that this legislation is going to encourage more of that. And because of how that guy got off, I don't think this is needed. I mean, I don't think he was in that much danger. He shot and killed him, and he still didn't get any penalty. So I don't really know where there's a need for this.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And seeing as we are out into the weeds here, let me give a couple comments as to how I define it as, for anybody that cares, how I define the difference between the Personal Carry Act and with regards to standing your ground. And Senator Hoffman makes a good point. Why should you have to back down when you're in public? I'll give you an example of a daughter who was having dinner with her parents in a state not that many years ago, and it's out there. You can find it, where the state said you could go ahead and carry a gun for personal protection. However, you cannot bring it into a public place. Somewhat similar to what our carry is now, if there's a sign. There was a gunman that came into that restaurant and held everybody up and eventually shot mom and dad. And she was able to live through it. And she, to this day, if given the opportunity to carry it in the restaurant, could have probably saved one of her parents at the very least and maybe somebody else in that business. That's what stand your ground is. And you don't have the opportunity, folks, to say, wait a minute, I've got my gun out in the car. In order to be fair, I want you to let me go out there and get my gun, bad guy. That doesn't happen, folks. It doesn't happen. The good people should be able to defend themselves. Senator Cohen, the Arizona shooting was a tragedy, and we watched the news, and that's how we got our information. But if you'd have watched the news in totality, I'm not saying you did or didn't, but there was also a carry person that was heading the direction of the gunfire. And he was heading in a direction to see what was going on, and we found that somebody had wrestled this gunman to the ground. He did not have to deploy his weapon, but if he would have had to, how many could he possibly have saved if that person would have kept on shooting? How many? Again, we're talking about the good folks, the ones that are doing it right, and anybody that doesn't want to allow their citizens, the people that put them in office, the right to protect themselves, especially in the Midwest, where we just don't have the problems they have in these big cities that you talk about in Detroit and San Francisco and New York. We're Midwesterners, but we should certainly allow our folks to be able to protect themselves at the very least.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair, I want to Senator Cohen may have something to that point.
Madam Chair, Senator Ingberts, I raised Arizona in the context of the amendment, which we've now dispensed with. So the comment I made was relative to that section of the amendment, not anything else. Your comment still begs the question, at least in my mind, as to what the need is. Because when you talk about the restaurant situation, if somebody had a firearm on their person legally, I'm not sure under that circumstance, I'm not the expert, that there would have been a prohibition against that person trying to defend her parents. Now, again, I'm not the legal expert on this. So that's why I'm trying to figure out how this law enhances present law in a way where the potential consequences are one, not more negative than what exists right now, and two, if it's even necessary under present law. That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen, Senator
Cohen, if there was a sign that you see, and we talked about this in judiciary, you weren't there, but there's a sign that's somewhat sometimes posted in the bank. I'll use as an example, and that's a good example, I think. No guns allowed in the bank. And I'm sure that's stopped a lot of bank robberies. It just hasn't. And if it's against the law in this particular state to bring a gun into a public place, that means you've got to leave it in the car. This bill says you don't have to. This woman could have protected and maybe saved one of her parents. And maybe both. There were several people that were shot in this incident.
So Madam Chair, just on that point, can I inquire then as to what section of the bill changes that posting?
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Well, I think, Madam Chair, I think the whole bill would actually change the posting. The posting is going to be null and void. You can still post all you want, but you're going to be able to carry your gun into a business and be able to defend yourself in a car should somebody at the stoplight someday decide to make the bad choice, to make the choice to steal your car. You're going to have a way of protecting yourself.
Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This bill actually makes no changes in the provision of that. I just was talking to Professor Olson, and in the statute the way it is, this bill doesn't touch into that part of the statute. This is just to stand your ground, to enhance the stand your ground provisions that we already have, or the protection provisions that we already have. This actually means that when I'm walking from my house to my shed, I don't have to run back into my house. And I live in the country, so there's been a couple of shady characters in my yard a few times in the 20 years that I've lived in the country. So thanks, Senator Ingebrigtsen.
She's in Otter Tail County. That never happened in Douglas County.
But anyway, I just wanted to clear that up, that this bill doesn't get into that part of the current statute.
Senator Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Senator Ingebrigtsen, that example doesn't count. But anyways, with regard to this bill, I'm very concerned about the potential for increased violence in our communities. And I think a naive comment was made at the table when it was said that, you know, we're the Midwest, we're Minnesota, we don't have the problems of New York. You know, right now there's a nickname for Minneapolis, Murderapolis. There is a tremendous amount of crime.
Not for years.
Well, There's a tremendous amount of crime in North Minneapolis, and there mm-hmm. still is. Senator Higgins, it's not an insult, but read the paper. It's not about saying that there's been progress, but we have crime in Minneapolis. We do have crime in Minneapolis. And so I think that anything which potentially expands the opportunity for gun violence is something that I oppose. And I think that something that puts our peace officers at risk, and that's what our peace officers are saying. They are standing up, and I just got my police chief today from one of my cities, sent me his email from Minnetonka, and said, please vote against this. We think that this will make us things less safe. My other police chief from Plymouth stood up next to Senator Harrington when he had his press conference to say they oppose this. When you have the police officers from our community standing up saying, do not go in this direction, this makes us less safe, why would we as a legislature impose our judgment over that of our police officers to say, no, you're wrong, this is something that we should do? I have not heard of anyone saying that there's a problem with regard to not being able to defend themselves. You go to court, if you shoot somebody to defend yourself, I suspect that you're going to prevail in a court of law. I don't think that that is the case, that you, in fact, would be told that you were a criminal because you defended yourself. I think there is common sense and that we can trust the courts and the judges. So, Senator Higgins, I apologize if my comments were insensitive. I didn't mean it in that way.
Madam Chair, just once, I'd like somebody to use some reference other than where I live.
I apologize.
I didn't.
Senator Ingalls did.
I knew that was rather sensitive, so I didn't.
I apologize.
Senator Burgess.
The new age guy.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bonner.
Madam Chair. Thank you, Madam Chair. I haven't yielded the. Senator Higgins took me on a tour a couple years back to ride with some young people who had created this foundation, the Peace Foundation, and they shared stories, story after story after story with me of their loved ones who had been shot and would point to that corner and that corner. And I'll never forget that ride. That ride will stay with me for the rest of my life. So why I made those comments wasn't to deride your community. It was because those young people who are doing everything they can to prevent gun violence made an impression on me that I won't forget, and I thank you for that tour.
And Madam Chair, just because Senator Higgins is feeling poorly about this, I just want to indicate, Senator Higgins, in reference to your comment, the most significant and famous homicide in Minnesota history took place in my district.
Yay!
Senator Berglund.
Which one was that?
Well, I just wanted to help remind people that a gun-carrying permit holder in Minneapolis in front of Nye's restaurant shot somebody who was an innocent victim and killed mm-hmm. them. And that happened in my city. Doesn't matter to me whether it was my district or somebody else's district. I don't believe this bill is going to help prevent that kind of situation from happening again.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Senator Berglund's comment, now that would be legal as long as under this bill, as long as they say they were afraid that they were in danger. It's much more extensive than what's in current law. I'm also on the Judiciary Committee, and we did go over this for quite a while in Judiciary. But there are provisions in here that are nothing like anything we've ever had. And one is that particularly the permit issue is alarming, because when we are going to allow permits from any other state, even if they don't have the same kind of training, they don't have maybe any training in gun safety. And we're also going to allow people to protect themselves with a weapon when they're in a boat, in a tent, in a campground, anywhere. It doesn't have to be in their own yard. Excuse me, folks. But the other thing is that my phone is going crazy. So we have the universal permit acceptance problem. We have the guns We have the fact that the police can't take a gun away when they go into a domestic violence situation because they're not allowed also by this bill to take guns away from people and confiscate them if there's a problem even. We also have the issue of gangs being able to shoot other gang members or whatever and be able to get away with it if they were afraid. So it's not necessarily law-abiding citizens. It can be criminals or even unconvicted criminals that have access to this. A police officer running through neighborhoods to chase somebody in pursuit of somebody can be shot and killed if the homeowner feels like that in the dark, doesn't see as a police officer, can go ahead and shoot them if they feel like they are being threatened by whoever it is that's running through their yard any time of day or night. This is extremely extensive, and it's extremely dangerous. And I just think that this is one of the many big mistakes we're making this session. But it certainly isn't for those of us that live anywhere near and have seen this kind of gun problem. Too often the people that actually need to defend themselves can't defend themselves. There's more evidence that people that have a gun have more difficulty with criminals grabbing the guns. And, it's just bringing us back so far back. And I know there's areas of the state where they probably feel like they need this, but I really feel sorry for people that are that afraid. I've lived in the city all my life. I've lived in the inner ring suburbs all my life, and I've never had to carry a gun or I'd ever had to worry about carrying a gun. I really think that this is very, very, very dangerous legislation. I think we do need to talk about it in as many committees as we can, and we certainly need to talk about it before we have a vote on it.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In listening to Senator Goodwin, I have to respectfully disagree with her assertions that this bill will allow someone with a permit to carry to shoot someone simply because they are afraid or because someone is running through their yard. And if you look at the bill where it talks in terms of use of deadly force in defense of the home and person, if you go to beginning on line 6.15, it outlines the circumstances when the use of that deadly force can be used. And nowhere in that language is language that says you can shoot somebody if you're afraid or if there's somebody running through your yard. In point of fact, it specifically indicates that that type of force can be used to resist or prevent a commission of a felony in your home. If you reasonably believe that you are imminently exposed to substantial bodily harm, great bodily harm, or death, if you reasonably believe that there is an imminent commission of a forcible felony and so forth, nowhere in this language is anyone authorized to do what Senator Goodwin is alleging they are allowed to do. So, I really didn't realize we were going to get this far afield in the Finance Committee, but, in terms of talking about the policy of this bill. But please be accurate when you are describing when the force of, deadly force is to be allowed.
Madam Chair, to that point.
Senator Goodwin.
Reasonably.
We are trying to
wrap
this up.
I understand. This is an important piece of legislation. I understand. But when I say fear, I say that doesn't differ much from reasonably believe. They can reasonably believe and they can have fear at the same time, and that's enough. Reasonably believe is in the eyes of the beholder.
Senator Ingebertson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm going to finish here. I just got to address a couple of the issues. With regards to Senator Higgins' comments about other states in the last page there, that was dealt with in judiciary, where a Minnesota resident cannot go to another state and get a permit. They have to do it in Minnesota.
Is that what
very good,
sentence means?
And we have very good records. In other words, yeah, because if Utah has, you go to the counter and sign up and you get it, we can't do that in Minnesota. If you live in Minnesota, you have to go through the very stringent exercises. Now, Senator, talking about this bill, putting guns in the wrong hands, there's nothing in this legislature that's saying that we're going to give more guns to bad guys, so that doesn't really pertain to anything. I'm sorry. Senator Berglund made a good comment with regards to somebody being shot with a handgun permit. And if it was wrongful, we can pass laws until the cows come home around here. There are going to be tragedies. There are going to be mistakes. There are going to be some of those things. But to point out one here and one there in a population of 5 million people, I think that's a little over the edge. And to Senator Newman's point, homeowners shooting people just running through the yard, the element of proof there is people just aren't going to be shooting. And if that's the case, they're going to shoot somebody running through the yard, then whoever does the shooting is going to go to jail. There's just no question about it. So, members, we're spending an awful lot of time talking about policy here, but I guess it has to happen. We need to pass something that's going to help protect the folks, if they choose, to protect themselves with a firearm, and that's the very least we should do under the Second Amendment.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
If that last paragraph means what Senator Ingebrigtsen says it does, could Senate counsel fix it so I could read it and make that out of that? Because I read that sentence over and over and over, and it made no sense. So maybe they could find a better way to say that so it's more clear. I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, and to her point with regards to it not being the way she liked the words in here.
No, it's not the way I like them. I can't interpret them correctly.
It's written by the reviser that writes all our bills. So if there's some punctuation things, and I do see that some of the sentences are cut off where the I's aren't dotted and the T's aren't crossed.
That's
but
the
I, you know,
part I was talking about.
I don't, think that's, we, what you're, I don't think that's what you're talking
deal
about.
Deal with that. Senator Hoffman will make sure that those things get corrected. So let's go back to the bill, and I'd like to bring it to a vote now, but I do usually offer anyone in the public who would like to make a brief comment for or against the bill before we vote.
Would I ask for a recorded vote?
I think it's been requested.
Okay.
You want
to if there's no other comments, Senator Perry moves that Senate File 1357 as amended be recommended to pass. Senator Cohen?
Madam Chair, you indicated that Professor Olson was had requested to testify, but I had requested, I don't know if he would like to, but Mr. Flaherty, if we might have just a little bit on the record, because, Madam Chair, I don't serve on the Judiciary Committee. I was kicked off that committee a few years ago by Senator Betzold, so I didn't get a chance to spend as much time on this bill. But I've been struck by the little bit I've heard, and from folks in my district, folks in my city, with the vehemence of opposition by law enforcement in the state. Not 100% of law enforcement, but what seems to me to be a pretty significant percentage of law enforcement. And so I was hoping Mr. Flaherty could just, for this committee, put a couple comments on the record.
Mr. Flaherty, if you so desire.
Okay, Madam Chair and members, for the record, my name is Dennis Flaherty. I'm executive director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, which is a rank-and-file association of about 8,500 officers employed throughout the state of Minnesota. And I think it was a week ago this day that I testified in Room 15, in along with other law enforcement organizations, county attorneys, chiefs, opposed to Senator Hoffman's bill. And we are very, very concerned about it. Primarily from an officer safety standpoint, the Castle Doctrine makes some interesting, there's verbiage in there that says anyone that enters a home by force or stealth. Well, we have police officers every day in every one of your districts that go on private property, most often without permission, executing anything from arrest warrants, search warrants, no-knock warrants, and we enter homes by force and by stealth. And we are very concerned about what this mentality now that's going to be created by this new legislation, what impact will that have on the safety of our officers? We're also very concerned about the definition of one's castle. Now it has been expanded to include decks and yards and garages and sheds, and you know, I don't, as someone from the county attorneys, I think said it best, do we really want to shoot and kill somebody that comes into a garage to steal a bicycle? And we're concerned about people from other states that do have a valid permit to carry, but they don't have any of the kind of requirements or standards that Minnesota permit holders have to have, but yet we have to honor a permit that's been issued anywhere by any state or governmental agency in the United States. We have a very much a concern of that, because we require more than that out of our permit holder. Senator Hoffman had to go through much more to get her permit than perhaps somebody from Idaho or you know, I don't know the whole litany of states, but and what their requirements are. I know we currently allow 15 other states now to have reciprocity, and that's because someone in public safety checked them out and found that their standards were similar or identical to ours. Fine. They can carry a gun. Their permit is valid. It's posted on the internet, and law enforcement knows which permits are good or not. But to just open it up to anybody, I think that's not good, sound policy. And we're also concerned about the language that talks about confiscating, when an officer can confiscate a gun. And although it says the provision only applies in disaster situations, there's language in this bill that says notwithstanding any law to the contrary, and it's confusing at best. We have officers that are called into domestic disputes when people are at their all-time worst on drugs, booze, family fights, and there's threats of firearms or actually firearms in plain sight. We, as a matter of course, take those into custody, bring them to the station, property inventory them, hold them until cooler heads will prevail and they can come and get them. It's questionable whether or not this bill will allow us to do that. We save a lot of lives by doing things like that. So, I mean, without going too deep into the weeds, I think, as Senator Ingebrigtsen said, that generally is why. And obviously, you know, people in law enforcement and prosecutors are very concerned about public safety, and we're concerned that this bill is really contrary to good, sound public safety in our state. The laws we have now more than adequately allow a citizen to safeguard their home, their family, and these changes are really not necessary in our opinion. And just in summation, you could never get anybody in law enforcement to agree 100% on any issue. So, yes, I know there are people that may feel differently than what I just testified to, but I you can be assured that the overwhelming majority of, at least I'll speak for rank and file, would want me to oppose this bill. They've asked me to oppose the bill. So,
thank you, Mr. Flaherty. And I think, for the record, you are correct. There are people on the other side of the issue who are licensed law enforcement officers, including the House author of the bill, who's in the room today, Representative Tony Cornish. And so there are differences of opinion. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
If I could just ask one question. Can't let you off that easy. Just real quickly, in Minnesota, since the handgun permit law has passed, how many violent crimes have been committed by permit holders? You know?
Madam Chair and Senator, no, I don't.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
And to that, and I know this, and you do as well, but maybe it'll mean more coming from you, that if there is such a crime committed again, you know, by somebody, or if times change, people end up in mental situations where they become dangerous to themselves or others, and they have a handgun carry permit, there are mechanisms in place to take those permits and revoke those permits, are there not?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes.
Thanks.
Senator Nino?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question. Some of that just came back. I was here the first two times we passed the revisions to the permit to carry it to the shall issue language, and I probably should remember, but I don't. I don't recall, did the MPPOA support or oppose that shall issue change in the carry permit law?
Mr. Flaherty?
Madam Chair, I was not here. I was here many years prior to that and then left, but I do believe the MPPOA opposed the expansion of that law.
If there's no further testimony, Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, what Senator Ingebrigtsen was just saying about being able to suspend or revoke a valid permit, I think if you look on page 4, line 15, it seems to say that notwithstanding any other law to the contrary, no government unit, official, and a whole bunch of other people in a really, really long sentence can suspend or revoke a valid permit issued pursuant to blah, blah, blah. So it seems to be saying that we're going to now say nobody can have their permits suspended?
I'm sorry, what portion is that?
415, 4.15.
What's this?
No, it says, you got to go way back up to, the sentence starts on 4.6.
Madam Chair.
So Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you continue reading on in line 4.16, it says, except as expressly authorized in those sections or, and then the bill goes on. So there's, doesn't just stop there.
Two more periods missing in that sentence.
Senator Perry renews his motion that Senate File 1357 be recommended to pass as amended and sent to the floor to be placed on general orders. And we have had a roll call requested, and we will take the roll.
Senator Berglund?
No.
Senator Bonhoff?
No.
Senator Cohen?
No.
Senator Fischbach?
Yes.
Senator Goodwin?
No.
Senator Higgins? Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Yes.
Senator Langseth?
No.
Senator Magnus?
Yes.
Senator Newman?
Yes.
Senator Nienau?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Perry?
Yes.
Chair Roebling?
Yes. On a vote of 8-6, the motion does prevail. The bill is passed and will be placed on general orders.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
The next bill we have up is Senator Nelson's bill, Senate File 907. It's relating to state building efficiency, fleet management improvements, and Medicaid and tax fraud prevention and detection.
Just saying.
Here comes Senator Nelson. Senator Nelson, you are up. Welcome to the committee.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. It's dropped.
Because I wait for that wisdom from you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for hearing Senate File 907, the analytics bill. I presented Senate, and I'm wondering, is there someone who wants to move this?
Senator Nino moves Senate File 907.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And there's one amendment that perhaps we should, an author's amendment. It's the A4. If we could, I have someone move that maybe and get it in the shape the bill needs to be in.
Senator Olson moves the A4 amendment.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
I don't know if that's an author's amendment because it probably has been amended before.
Oh, it's
so
not
I think
an author's amendment.
I think we should have the amendment and see what we're doing before we.
Right. No, I wasn't ready to call for a vote by any means.
Madam Chair, maybe I can just mention a little bit about what this amendment is.
Yes,
and
please
why it's
do,
here.
Senator Nelson.
This amendment was a result of some of the concerns that admin had when we presented this bill in other committees. This amendment was added last night in the conference committee for state gov, and the idea is to make sure that we're not talking about requiring analytics in all buildings, but in buildings that are instrumented, and if there's significant savings, and it goes on to define a little bit about how those savings can be defined and measured and verified. So it's more comfort language for the Department of Admin.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, if it was put in the conference committee report, is it necessary to run it separately? Or maybe the question is, are we being wise instead in running it separately?
Senator Nelson?
Senator Higgins, are you asking me, do I want to have this as a standalone bill? Was that the genesis of your question?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, it is a standalone bill, so.
Mm-hmm.
Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, I think it is good comfort language for the Department of Admin. We visited about these things in March when I presented this to the state government committee, and the Department of Admin had talked about these things at that time. I said I'd certainly be glad to add any comfort language that they wished, and I didn't hear back from them. But they were at the conference committee last night, and this was language that was intended to make them more comfortable.
Senator Nelson, she was asking if you wanted this to be a standalone bill if it was already in the state government bill, and not just the amendment language.
Yes, Madam Chair. Yes, I do think I would like this to be a standalone bill. We just don't know what's going to happen with all of our conference conference committee reports and bills, and I think it's we've done many bills that are standalone bills and also in conference and omnibus bills. So, yes, I would like it to be a standalone bill, Madam Chair.
Are there any questions on the A4 amendment? Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, I don't know if somebody from the department, if you've seen the language, if this deals with concerns you had with the bill as introduced.
Mr. Rhodes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is the amendment that as Representative Benson put into the bill after some discussion. To be fair, the issue is what's the fiscal note, and this is the Finance Committee. The fiscal note was high because of the way the bill was originally drafted. And the question came up last night about through conversations with Representative Benson as well, that the how can we get the fiscal note down? And he came up with some of this language because the governor has also put out for an RFP doing these same things that are requested in this bill, most of them, I think.
Yes,
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, the governor instituted two executive orders on April 8th and April 12th, implementing most parts of this bill. And this bill did call for state agencies to issue requests for proposals in smart buildings, fleet management, tax fraud, and Medicaid fraud detection and prevention. The RFPs, according to this proposal and what the governor instituted by executive order then, after that called for vendors to submit proposals requiring that the vendors be paid on the back end out of recouped savings. So if there's no savings, there's no payment. So that was what the governor also included in his RFPs. And the interesting thing about that there was no fiscal note attached to the RFPs that are already out. They're already on the street. And so if anything, one would think the fiscal note for this bill would certainly be about $500,000 less because there was money included in this fiscal note for RFPs. The governor has since implemented Senate File 907 through executive order. I think the question might be, well, if he's implemented it, why in the world do you want to do this bill? Or Senator Higgins might ask me, why do you want to do a standalone bill on something the governor has just implemented through executive order? The point is, yes, the RFPs are out there. I think we as legislators want to make sure that these are implemented. There is no savings just from RFPs. We want to make sure that the RFPs are implemented, the chosen vendor. So I think there is reason to continue, and I think the fiscal note would be less now since the governor has already claimed hundreds of millions of dollars of savings just on the smart building piece that's in his press release. So I think the governor has acknowledged that there's hundreds of millions of dollars of savings just in the smart buildings part of this bill. So I don't know that the fiscal note actually should be an issue here at this point after the governor's already implemented it.
Madam Chair, members,
Mr. Ross.
Senator Perry asked the question, well, if the governor's doing it for free, and Senator Representative Benson said the same thing, why can't we? There's a little difference here that the bill is very prescriptive as it is drafted, and what the governor is, his RFPs is phase one, not phase one, two, three, four, and five. So that's just the start. And by the way, we applaud this idea that Senator Nelson has had, Representative Benson. The Department Administration is the forefront of how we can transform government. The LEAN program has been extremely successful. In fact, if I may just give a little update, Wisconsin has contacted us today to do a LEAN program over there, and Tennessee sent two people up from their government to do the LEAN program down there. So we are innovative, and we do those kinds of things, and we work with General Mills doing all these kinds of things. So we're with you on this. The issue at hand, though, is how much you're requiring a department to do versus what the governor's RFP does. And that is where the cost factor is. If it's the governor's is permissive, and by the way, we had over 40 people, 40 vendors inquire about doing stuff like this. So this is, we're on the right track, and we applaud everybody for going this way. We're with you. We just, how much can we do is what it boils down to. And that's where the fiscal cost is. And I have my experts back here that would be happy to tell you all the wonderful things that they can do that's been done and what we are asked to do in the bill that we can't do that cheap.
Well, members, before we do any of that, let's go back to the A4 amendment, which was moved by Senator Olson when it was being distributed, and I think we've had ample time to look at it, and Senator Nelson has explained that most of this is language recommended by administration.
Madam Chair, it's not members' committee. This was brought by Representative Benson at the hearing last night.
I'm sorry. So it has been included in an omnibus bill, but it is clarifying language, Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, if the department doesn't find this language acceptable, I will withdraw this amendment, and I'll continue with my bill in its current form. We don't need to add this amendment if it's not addressing their concerns. We'll just I withdraw the amendment.
Well, before you, Mr. Rhodes.
Senator Nelson, Madam Chair, before you withdraw the amendment, hang on a second. It's a work in progress, if you will, and what's in the amendment, technically we can speak to, but it's a start in the process of trying to get some of the situations done. What the amendment, what the bill has every state building, and what the amendment does, it clears up that every state, because every state building could be a salt shed, a lean-to, a little shack someplace. So they talked about refining, and that's how this amendment came up.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, I think I would have to withdraw the amendment since I offered it, but do you have any reason to disagree with the wording of the amendment?
I'll leave that up to my expert here.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Wayne Wislowski, Director of Real Estate and Construction Services, and I apologize, Senator Olson, if you could just repeat the question for me.
Madam Chair. Is there any point of disagreement with the amendment that I've offered? The A4 amendment.
Madam, Mr. Wislowski.
Madam Chair, Senator.
Does this improve or do nothing or take it in the wrong direction?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I think we might have some refinements on it. We do think it's an improvement. In particular, what it picks up is instead of all state buildings, it's focusing in on instrumented buildings. The one thing it's probably not doing is addressing the issue is that there's all sorts of different levels of instrumentation in buildings. So really the first step, and this was covered in the governor's executive order, is to do an assessment of the building automation systems that are in place at, we have to remember there's 14 different agencies that are involved in managing our over 5,000 state buildings. So there is a baseline assessment that has to happen across the state, all of our state facilities, to say what is in place. And that gets to the point of the amendment doesn't address entirely the issue of the fiscal note. We're still looking at, you're talking about an IT project here and also an energy efficiency project, so bringing the right expertise to the table from an energy management standpoint and from an IT standpoint, that's the fiscal impact. And that, by the way, is, we've had extensive meetings with IBM about this technology, and you know, they brought those similar skill sets to the table when they were deploying this technology. So I think it validated from our standpoint who we thought needed to be at the table to implement the technology.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, thank you. Could you just explain what instrumented means? Is it something as simple as a thermostat on the wall? I mean, or how sophisticated does it need to be before you use that terminology?
Mr. Wasilowski.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, that's a great question. That's the one of the areas that IBM was very helpful for us. When they did this is a new technology that they've developed. They did it on 87 air handling units at their Rochester, Minnesota campus. And so if you're talking about the sensors within those air handling units that really guide how those the rules around how those air handling units operate, that's how what they focused on their campus. So you are talking about instrumentation measuring the indoor temperature, it's measuring the outdoor temperature, it's measuring humidity, and it's really telling those air handling units, giving them rules. If you have this temperature with this level of humidity, and here's what you're trying to get to for an indoor temperature, here's how your air handling unit should be operating. It's optimizing how you're operating that air handling unit versus what happens now is when we're in, I'll use room 123 because that's the one that we have a real tough time controlling. It's complaint driven. So we hear from an occupant that says it's cold in here or it's warm in here. This technology has the potential of sending an instant notification to say you have an air handling unit that's not operating within the rules that you set up based on the data that it's collecting with the instrumentation.
So, Senator Olson.
Bless you. So, Madam Chair, Mr. Wasilowski, so the instrumentation, if they're already instrumented, are they already gathering that data, or how does this apply? Amplify on that just a bit more for me.
Mr. Wasilowski.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, so if you think about it, is that instrumentation is the data collection system. This is the analytical tool. If you implement this technology, it's the analytical tool that overlays that data collection system. And those data collection points, those systems within our state facilities across all of our different state facilities, we have just a wide variety. It's not just about the hardware that's in place. It's also about the software. It's about what do you have for a database to store the data. So it is this combination of a building project married with an IT project that you're talking about.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Olson,
having said that, you think it's just as well to remove, not to add this amendment, or is there some suggested change that you would have that would make it acceptable in terms of a feasible implementation? In your mind,
Mr. Wasilowski.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, I don't have any the suggested changes. I think part of what we were looking and talking about is I think just from a broader procurement standpoint, there's some. Mr. Robes talked about it, some of the prescriptive features in the bill, and including that's some shells versus maize that we typically see with our procurement. So those are the kind of things that if you had May in there that you could then have some flexibility about how the RFP is drafted.
Madam Chair, then having heard that, Senator Nelson, do you wish to have the amendment withdrawn?
Yes.
I will withdraw the amendment.
Senator Nelson, I like your amendment. Yep, Madam Chair. I like the amendment. It narrows the scope anyway. So they don't have to deal with salt sheds and things like that.
Yeah.
So I don't know. If it's withdrawn, it's withdrawn.
Madam Chair.
Senator Bono.
Madam Chair, I'll offer the A4 amendment. And Senator Nelson, I think it's really important that you included, and it sounds like there could be some work done on it, and you'd have time between now and the floor. But look, the reason why I'm offering it is, if you recall, when the State Government Reform Committee put forward some reform initiatives and tried to put assumptions as to what the savings were, nobody could verify whether or not those savings were accurate. And there's quite a bit of conflict around that. And all of the reform initiatives that I've been working on, the question always comes back to, well, how will you know if you really have saved anything? And I think that is one of the most important things that we can do as we go down this road, is make sure there's agreement up front how you define savings, how you define these things on both sides. And that way we can begin to budget with an eye towards return on investment. And I think that we're going in that direction, and that's the direction we ought to be going, and that if the language isn't quite right, again, this is just the Finance Committee. I think you can fix it.
Senator Nelson.
Well, Madam Chair, I did have this amendment drafted because I thought it was a good amendment. I thought it was a step in the right direction. But quite frankly, my bill has been in the hopper now since probably the 1st of March. And these concerns were brought up in State Gov, and I never got any input from admin about how to fix it. So I've got something here that I think is helpful, and certainly I'm more than willing to work with admin to make it work. I'm glad the governor thought it was a great idea and signed it into law, but I have no problems adding the amendment. I'd kind of, if we can continue to work on it, that's fine. If it was of no help, I would just as soon, get rid of it. But as long as we're willing to work on it, I have no problems with that. And once we take care of this amendment issue, I'd kind of like to finish presenting the bill.
But I have a question.
Senator Goodwin. No, Senator Bonnef has reoffered the amendment. Senator Goodwin, do you have a comment to the amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, it's in general to the amendment and to the bill, because I'm not sure how the amendment will work without knowing this about the bill. Perhaps Mr. W. or Mr. Mr. Rhodes can answer this for me. If this bill, compared to the governor's with the amendment, this bill compared to the governor's executive order, is this bill more prescriptive so that it would reduce the number of vendors that would actually be eligible to apply for these projects? Would it limit the number of vendors that would probably be eligible to apply?
Madam Chair, Senator Goodwin, I think that gets to one of the concerns, and it does talk about making an award to one vendor, and in with our building situations, there's many vendors that compete for this type of business, and we have existing types of automation systems, multiple. We don't have one building automation system. We have many different vendors that have automation systems in their in our state facilities. So one of the concerns would be that the best value for the state could be that we upgrade our existing systems versus having just one system for the entire state. So that is a potential concern.
But Mr. Wasilewski, that doesn't relate to this amendment, does it?
No, Madam Chair, I apologize.
Madam Chair, I'm asking about the bill with this amendment added. So if this amendment is added, does it change it? But then I'd like to continue my question if you want to go ahead and vote on the amendment first. But I do want the answer to that question.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, most of the conversation about this bill so far has been about buildings, which I'm fine with trying to improve the energy efficiency of our buildings, but there is a section on, fraud and abuse in the Medicaid system, and that doesn't have to do with buildings, but I'm assuming this amendment has to do with the whole bill.
Actually, Senator Berglund, I think it has to do with buildings. That's why we've been talking about buildings so far. The amendment has to do with buildings.
This amendment doesn't have anything to do with the Medicaid fraud and abuse section?
True. Senator Nelson.
This part was added specifically for the buildings. It talks about instrumented buildings, so there's not going to be, you know, instrumented Medicaid fraud regarding buildings. But I do think, Senator Berglund, that once I get to present the bill and we talk about the Medicaid provisions, there certainly may be a line that I think is helpful as far as defining savings and verifying what is savings. I do think that particular section of the amendment would be applicable to the Medicaid fraud detection and prevention.
Can we go back and deal with the A4 amendment, and then we'll have Senator Nelson give us a brief overview of the entire bill, and we'll talk about the fiscal impacts of the bill before we proceed further. So does everyone understand the A4 amendment? It actually, I think, narrows the scope of which buildings will be affected by this. It means they need to be instrumented, or that they would be heated and maybe air-conditioned or something. They wouldn't be the salt shed where they keep the salt for the State Highway Department. So all in favor of the A4 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The motion does prevail. The amendment is adopted. Now, Senator Nelson, did you have another amendment, or did you want to do a quick walkthrough through the bill?
I'd really like to do a quick overview of the bill, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you for your patience as we kind of maybe got sidetracked on that amendment piece. Senate file, I'd like to just tell you a little bit about where the idea for this bill came from, which was commercials on TV, actually. You've seen the logistics commercials about UPS, and you've heard about Build a Smarter Planet, Build a Smarter City. And that's actually, you've probably seen those commercials. They're all based on analytics and using real-time analytic data to deliver services in a more efficient and effective way. And that's the goal of this legislation. And I'll just give you a background since we're kind of just left the building piece. I visited the IBM Rochester campus to see how they have done this. They're the only they've done this as a pilot on their campus. They overlaid analytics with the Johnson Controls, which is what they're already using to run their buildings and to make sure that they're energy efficient and they're using energy wisely. And I think many of our state buildings use Johnson Controls too. Is that correct?
Senator, it's Johnson Controls and Honeywell as well. There's multiple vendors, but those are two of the big ones.
So what this does is just overlays analytics on top of the good building management that the state is already doing. When they did that at IBM, and they overlaid analytics on top of Johnson Controls of their 36 buildings, 3.1 million square feet, in just 8 months, they have reduced their year-to-date energy costs by 8%. Now, for that, it took about three-quarters of one of the equivalent of one full-time employee, about 1 month, to gather the data and implement that phase. So I just kind of want to give you that as sort of a guideline. And in these difficult budget times, I think that we're lucky to have high-tech tools to give us options like real-time analytics so that we can realize savings and we can use tested best practices. And the other piece of this bill, then, in addition to applying analytics to smart buildings, it also requires that same analytics applied to fleet management. And you might go back and think about the commercial for UPS that you've seen about logistics. That's what we're talking about here as part of that. And then to Senator Berglund's concern about Medicaid tax and tax fraud, both a detection, it's better to detect, and prevention. I mean, it's better to prevent first and not send out the fraudulent payments up front, and also detection if we have. So that's actually where the quickest payback is in the savings. And Minnesota has already done a good job on pieces of that. Again, this is just making it more efficient and more effective. And the thing I would like the committee to realize is that this is a really low risk or no risk option for the state. The bill specifically states that vendors have to upfront the cost. In other words, they have to be so sure that their solution is going to work that they there's no gain. If there's no savings for the state, there is no gain for the vendors. There's no payment to the vendors until after we have realized savings. So it's a proof of concept. And so this bill specifically states that there needs to be this proof of concept, which the governor incorporated with his RFPs, a proof of concept. And the proof of concept on smart buildings is just three buildings. We're just asking for three buildings, do a proof of concept. If there are significant savings, then we do roll it out on a statewide basis. And the same with fleet management and the tax fraud detection and prevention and for Medicaid. So I think with the difficult choices ahead of us, I think it's good we've got these tools. And I also think it's great that the vendors are, and there's several of them. There's many who have applied. I know when I first presented this bill, I think in Senator Perry's committee, people were saying, well, are there any vendors that are going to be willing to put themselves out on the line like this and not get paid unless there's savings or results? And there are. There's many. How many vendors took the RFPs so far?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe Betsy was 60 requests for.
Sure. Mr. Chair, we had 62 vendors request the request for proposal.
62 vendors.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to finish my question. Are you finished with your bill? I really want to finish my question here that I started, and that is if this bill is so prescriptive that, and I want to ask the department, that the language compared to what the governor's doing in his RFPs would limit the number of vendors that would be eligible to apply.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
I apologize. We didn't have any notes here, so I don't think you've stated your name for the record.
I apologize. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Betsy Hayes. I'm a contracts manager with the Department of Administration Materials Management Division, and it was my unit who issued the RFP that's gotten some mention today. Senator Goodwin, and I really appreciate the opportunity to speak here today, and I think I can clarify some of the ideas about what this RFP is really about. We put out an RFP on April 11th that is intended to form what's called a master contract program. This is a very broad, comprehensive RFP because we agree that the data analytics way to go shows a lot of promise. A lot of state agencies are already using analytics, but there's a good opportunity for vendors to partner with the state. We want that to be a very broad-based, very open, competitive process. So this master contract program establishes opportunities in 10 different categories of analytics, more even than are addressed in this bill, where we would hope that many vendors are eligible and participate in our awarded contracts in the various different categories. So we think that this is actually much, much more comprehensive than any individual RFP that would go out. Another aspect I think that's clarifying, because there has been questions fiscally about, you know, is the governor doing the same thing and why does one cost money and another doesn't? And the answer really is this is phase one. This gets the contractors on board. This sort of pre-qualifies the vendors in this category. But the work, as far as developing statements of work and creating an RFP under this broader RFP, is what would happen once this master contract is established. So while there is effort and staff time and lots of work in developing this master contract program, the costs really come into the next phases of the process.
Senator Olson, you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. It doesn't appear that there's any restriction on numbers of proposals in this bill. It does appear that you would end up selecting one. Now, when you talk about the master contract, are you looking at a contract that multiple vendors could participate in, or is there going to be one master vendor? Because perhaps what needs to happen here is to not make it appear that it is just one that is selected, but there would be the choices could be multiple based on the particular area of expertise or that they, in fact, do it with analytics. Could I get that answer from the department first?
Yes, Mr. Chair,
yes.
Senator Olson. The answer to that question is that the master contract would envisions multiple contractors. In fact, multiple contractors in each category would be given master contracts. When a particular agency then has a need that they would like resolved or have a particular project that they have in mind, they would issue a statement of work that would be issued, and in fact competition would occur amongst those qualified vendors in the particular category. So we think that and that's where the actual fiscal issues come into play. A couple of things about the bill as written that I didn't mention earlier that I think are in our minds of concern. Usually the commissioner has broad discretion to reject proposals. One of the things that the RFP that we've issued doesn't require upfront that you have to enter into a contract, and I think that's an issue that we need to take a look at in this bill. I think the amendment does help, but there might be some further things to look into. Also, I think, as was mentioned, there is a requirement in this bill that if certain conditions happen, you proceed to the next stage, which is doing the full implementation, and that is the condition is that there has to be a material savings shown. And oftentimes that can be very ambiguous and subjective, so that the state believes maybe one thing, the vendor believes another, and in our experience we are fearing that that might involve disputes, protests, and even at worst litigation. The other item that I think raises issues and concerns is with these contingency type contracts. The state agencies are really at an incentive to try to lower the amount. Let me put it this way. The contractors have an incentive to try to show as much savings as possible if they're being paid a contingency on that savings, obviously. There may be another side of it where the agencies are trying to minimize how much has been saved. And so we've seen in other states lots of disputes, litigations, and really horror stories about disagreements about what has actually been saved. So this particular master contract program that we have developed offers choices. It does offer for contingency-based payment if that the state agency, based on that circumstance, believes that that's appropriate. But it goes further to allow time and materials options and just more options with respect to vendor payment.
Senator Nelson, did you have anything to add?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just will say I am a fan of maximizing savings. I think that's a good thing for state government to do. So I like maximizing savings. I did want to mention the issue about vendors and, you know, exclusivity and that type of thing. And the proof of concept piece actually, and I visited with, I think maybe Mr. W was in my office as well as Mr. Rhodes. In looking at how can we do this, we know the state doesn't have the money to go out and purchase what is needed here for us to start maximizing these savings. And therefore, we looked at, well, how can we have vendors pay up front and get paid for those through those recoup savings. And one of the problems was if we did a pilot project, we wanted to make sure that if the vendors would do the pilot project and invest their time and resources in doing the pilot project, we wanted them to be eligible then to actually bid on the whole RFP for the whole proposal. And the point was, let's let the departments design the RFPs. So I take exception to this fact that this is a very prescriptive bill. The only thing prescriptive in this bill is that if there is savings generated, the programs must be rolled out. That is prescriptive. I know the department would like permissive language, but quite frankly, they've had permissive language. It hasn't happened yet. Although I will say, I know you were working with this even before I got involved. So I don't think it's prescriptive. I do believe that permissive language is not enough in this case, and the vendors are selected only on the RFP. So the agencies design the RFP. They select the vendors. And it's And there are individual vendors for in my bill for the individual parts of the bill. There's no reason that one vendor would be required to do all parts of this bill. Certainly each RFP, and as they design the RFPs, you know, they determine that and how many vendors would be selected. I do think there are economies of scale as far as having, and we know as a state government that there's all these different systems and sometimes they don't always talk to one another. So there is something good about having some sort of standardization as far as one system.
Senator Berglund.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the part of this bill that deals with Medicaid fraud looks very similar to a bill that we heard in the Health and Human Services Committee that was authored by Senator Benson. And I believe it was included in the omnibus bill. And so, you know, I'm not sure if we need to have this passed again or money was spent there, and I'm getting kind of nervous about spending this money over and over again, especially since the Department of Human Services has indicated that they have not been able to find a contractor that's willing to do this because they already have pretty good systems for detecting and preventing payments from going out. So I'm just, my question is, do we need to keep this section in this bill?
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. The Medicaid fraud piece was a part of the governor's executive order. I do believe that there have been vendors who have asked for RFPs for that aspect. So, Senator Berglund, to your question on the HHS committee, certainly I'm not part of your committee, so I wasn't there for all of your hearings, but I do know that Senator Benson offered, in order to get this into the omnibus bill, she did offer an amendment to the HHS bill, which included the language from this bill as far as the Medicaid fraud detection and prevention. So if it's sounding a little like you've heard it before, you have. Senator Benson offered this language as well.
Senator Berglund.
So, Mr. Chairman, then, you know, my concern about, in that bill, there were cuts made to pay for it. I don't know if there's any cuts being made to pay for it again or, you know, if the provision was adopted in that conference committee even, but it does always make me nervous when we're passing things that cost money and we don't have any savings to offset the cost.
Sure. Senator Berglund, the chair is not here, but her staff is telling me that they're not intending to appropriate for this particular bill. But Senator Nelson.
Mr. Chair, there is no cuts in this bill to any other programs. There's no, there should not be a fiscal note based upon, and maybe I just need to reiterate the kind of the basics of the of the bill. The bill actually states that the vendors provide at no cost to the state the pilot projects in each area. After there's determined savings, the vendor, whichever that selected vendor was, rolls out the program at their cost. There is no cost to the state except through recouped savings on the end. I think it is a legitimate piece to say that there might have been a cost for agencies to roll out the RFPs, although I know that Senator Metzen and I have often talked on the Jobs Committee about some of these things are just part of the being employed in the agency. You know, we don't need a fiscal note for everything we ask to be done, although there's certain things that obviously are larger than the typical regular responsibilities. But the wonderful thing about the governor's executive orders implementing this bill is that those RFPs are already out on the street. And because my bill asked that the departments define and write the RFPs, and I'm assuming it's the departments that defined and wrote the RFPs that the governor has already sent out, that's already out on the street, I think that piece of the fiscal note is no longer relevant. The governor jumped ahead of us. By executive order, the departments have issued RFPs doing exactly what my bill asked to be done. In fact, in some cases, many more things. Again, the only difference is, if I understand it correctly, my bill moves on to the second step. The governor has requested RFPs for pilots, if I understand that correctly. But my bill says implementation. So just the RFPs isn't enough.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Byrd, follow
up. Just one final comment, and that is that the Medicaid program doesn't allow you to take Medicaid funds to pay a vendor based on projected savings that might accrue. And when you do get savings in the Medicaid program, you have to send the federal share back to the federal government, and you have to put the state share back in the general fund. So your bill doesn't work in this area. That's, you know, so you would have to, you would have to appropriate money to get it to happen. And if we're not going to appropriate money for the bill, then this section isn't going to happen anyway.
Senator Perry, to this point?
Are we talking fiscal notes here? Or what?
I was.
Well, cost to.
Senator Perry.
Well, I just, thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll go back. I think we had the discussion last night. So the RFPs are out. What was the governor's fiscal note to do that?
Mr. Wasilowski?
Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, there wasn't a fiscal. That RFP was developed with state staff.
Senator Perry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you're telling me that because we're having state staff develop RFPs, we have a fiscal note, but the governor can direct state staff to develop RFPs with no fiscal notes. I'm trying to get a handle. We were trying to get there last night in state gov. That's why I'm trying to say if we're not concerned about the fiscal note because the RFPs are already out there, the governor's already spent the money to do the RFPs, so some of that money from DHS had to go there because they had to talk to those employees, so the governor spent the money for the RFPs. So we shouldn't have to worry about this fiscal note, correct?
Senator Perry, thank you for the chance to clarify this. What has happened based on the RFP that was issued by admin, that was an RFP that creates this master contract program. And it's not, that's really something that's being done by admin and with the assistance of a steering team, a statewide steering team, that is something that we are have been able to absorb. However, the next step that would happen underneath this master contract program would be the step where agencies assess their needs, their options, they develop their detailed scopes of work, they negotiate specifics of the engagement, and then they enter into the specific work order with a vendor that's been given a master contract. So it's that second stage, and then a third stage involves the implementation of whatever it is they've agreed to. So it's this first stage that we've been able to implement. It's not the second and third stages that are the subject of the fiscal note that these bills cover.
Senator Berglund, then Senator Perry.
Yeah, on that point, this fiscal note isn't about staff. They're not adding any staff.
No, I didn't say that.
Note requests, they've got money for systems costs here. They've got money for the contractor. And they indicate here in the fiscal note, you can't just appropriate money out of the Medicaid account. That's supposed to be going to Medicaid vendors to pay for this activity. You would have to appropriate it separately.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I didn't mean to insinuate that we were adding staff. What I'm trying to get at here is so that we can have some continuity. When it states that a significant investment of staff time from each agency with the responsibility for managing state buildings would be required at each site to gather information on existing conditions for the RFP. Now, if the governor can do that with no expense, we, as a legislature, when we want to move these projects, should be able to do it. They're our employees, too, I would say. So why isn't it we don't see the fiscal note on what the governor's doing with his RFPs? And all we see is what, I mean, it doesn't make sense that we couldn't get those numbers.
Mr. Wasilowski?
Mr. Chair, Senator Perry, and that's a good place for clarification. So on the master contract program,
The next phase of that will get specific to, we'll get site-specific on our building, so I'll use the Capitol campus. At that point, we will have to develop a specific scope of work for the Capitol campus based on our assessment of our existing condition with our instrumentation and our building automation system. It'll be very much focused on what are our existing systems that are in place. It'll take staff time to go around and complete that assessment and put that information together for an RFP that is site-specific. So that's the step that hasn't yet occurred under the master contract program, but that cost is, and I will say this fiscal note didn't include that cost. We didn't have a way of estimating that across all state facilities. What we focused on is you're going to need somebody, an expert in building automation systems that is helping facility staff at all of our state agencies to work through this. The gentleman at IBM that did this was very knowledgeable facility manager with these specific types of technologies. That's really what what we would be needing to provide for the state agencies, along with, this is a hardware and software, it's a technology project, so it is bringing on somebody to manage that IT component. So it is really getting to this second phase is where it isn't in that development of the RFP for a master contract, it's that next phase where you get really specific about how you would apply this technology to a specific campus. And it's going to be different. In the Capitol campus, we have 60,000 monitoring points. I mentioned in our previous testimony with the Honeywell system. Our Lionel Lakes Correctional Facility has a Johnson Control System. You're going to have many, many different systems. Every one of our facilities, our campuses, are going to be different.
Senator Olson and then Senator Bonoff has been patiently waiting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Lasky, in your discussion of the master contract, I'm trying to understand the role of admin. Is the overarching agency that deals with all of these? Now, each of these specific areas seem to refer to and direct the RFP, that whole process, in one case, revenue, and the other case, human services, but yours is only the physical facilities. Now, I know admin has overarching purchasing kinds of things that go beyond our facility areas. So what is that part of the issue here, that perhaps the governor's order may be somewhat different, that you are you the overseer of the whole enchilada, and then as it goes into the next steps, that the individual departments do get into the act? Can you clarify a little bit more how you function in relation to the other departments in carrying out a mission like this?
Ms. Hayes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, a few years ago in Chapter 16C, the legislature gave specific authority to the Department of Administration promoting doing contracts on an enterprise basis. So in many instances, especially in the professional technical area, where agencies were doing their own particular contracting, admin has, in the last several years, focused on doing enterprise contracts that can be used by other agencies, so there isn't all the redundant activities. And this is a really good example of where admin would be the primary overarching coordinator of this master contract program, and then individual agencies would write their own statements of work and things based on their needs, but they're using contracts that are entered into and administered by admin, and we have an oversight and administrative role in helping agencies use those particular contracts. So it's a shared experience with the agencies and admin, but admin is the enterprise sort of architect and administrator of the contracts.
Thank you.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to the concerns that Ms. Hayes mentioned, it seems to me that the amendment would prevent some of that from happening in terms of the concern around dispute, whether or not there really was savings and how much savings. So I think that That will go a long way towards smoothing that out. And then I know Senator Goodwin is no longer sitting here, but she had that concern about one vendor, and I wondered if Senator Nelson, you've considered every place where you say vendor, also saying vendor and then putting in parentheses, you know, an S, because in some cases it really might be best to have more than one vendor. I know I've gone out and met with Cargill to really understand their approach to systems change, and Cargill shared with me how by hiring two different vendors, they were able to really maximize the amount of savings they could get, because some have expertise in one part and another has an expertise in another, and it actually, the competition in some ways made it even a stronger proposal. So I'm just wondering if that might alleviate some concerns that are have been expressed about, you know, oh, is this a bill for this company or that company, which I don't think it is, but also would perhaps have a more open system.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonoff, I agree with you. Competition is a very good thing, especially in tight budget times. We definitely want to have all the potentials vendors list available. There are multiple vendors when it comes to the RFPs, but there have been numerous vendors, so that was a good thing. We weren't sure at first if there would be, but we're glad there's a number of vendors who are interested. I have no problems in looking at that language, and if there's, you know, and this is why this bill is so flexible for the departments actually to write those RFPs, so that they can determine how those RFPs are going to be written, because that determines really what the contract's going to look like. Mm-hmm. So if that's helpful to say vendors instead of vendor, I have no issue with that. Just to reiterate, this language is not written for any vendor. We want full competition, and certainly that's something I'd be willing to work with admin on before we would hopefully go to the floor.
Senator Bonoff?
Mr. Chair, so that we don't have to go through all sorts of technical things in this committee, it's getting late. If you would assure me that you would be willing to take care of that before it does get to the floor, that would be great. Otherwise, if council thinks it's easier to just add the plural now, I would leave it to the chair and council.
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think I see where the challenge or the difficulty is for the Department of Administration, in that the structure of this seems to differ from what the directive we have in current statute for this kind of oversight. When you talk about the master having the RFP for the master contract, when it gets down to the agency level, they're not working at the RFP level. They're mm-hmm. working within the structure of the master contract that you have with a multitude of vendors, and essentially laying out the statement of work. Now, maybe I'm missing something, but is it a structural? Is the challenge in the legislation the structural relationship with the Department of Admin, and how we have directed you in earlier legislation for overseeing this, these purchasing of goods and services and contracts for them?
Mr. Wasilowski?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, maybe I could just offer an example on the building efficiency side. What you would see, I gave the example of the Honeywell system that's here on the Capitol campus with the 60,000 monitoring points. If you had a master contract in place with multiple vendors, you'd have a specific statement of work for the Capitol campus. You would want to have that issued separately as a statement of work, so that everybody, all those vendors, compete for that work, for that type of system. And you wouldn't want to then have that same vendor also be the vendor that does the work automatically for the Lionel Lake situation. You'd want to have a separate statement of work in that situation and compete that business, because the best value for the state may be two very different vendors.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm thinking more umbrella than that even. Does your master contract and agreement, or for RFPs, go so far as to cover the tax fraud and the Medicaid, all of these areas that cover, you know, multiple agencies. Do you oversee all of that? Because I can see that if that is the case, the way the bill is constructed doesn't seem to reflect that. So perhaps you could clarify if my thinking is, or my interpretation of what I've been hearing is off base, or if it's accurate.
Sure. Thank you. Senator Olson, I think the best way to explain it is that the master contracts will be kind of the umbrella documents that are master contracts to perform work in a particular area. And then after those master contracts are established, and a particular project is identified by an agency, whether it be the Department of Revenue or the Department of Human Services, they have several master contract holders to present a project to and say, you can now compete for this particular work that we have. So the master contract is at a very high level. It's got many contractors under contract, and then the agencies, when they need particular work, they'll do almost, you could almost think of it as a mini RFP. It's a secondary RFP process that takes place after the big RFP has already been done to establish the master contracts in the first place.
Thank you.
Senator Bonoff, you were talking to council. Do you have something to offer us?
Mr. Chair, I'm not going to propose anything right now. And I'll talk to Senator Nelson later.
Okay. And members, any other questions? Mr. Rhodes.
Mr. Chairman, I think that leads to what I really feel I have to say is that we have a Senator Nelson, I've known when she became up, was originally in the other body. I think that I must tell you that she's right. I probably did not come and see her as often as I should about this bill. We did talk about it, and it was off and on, and I thought it was going to be permissive, and then I got involved, then it got a state government finance. So I will tell you, for on the record, that if we're going to work together, it's my issue to make sure that we do work together. We are all want admin, and everybody wants to do this to make it work right. We want to save money. We want to do things right. Senator Perry is correct when he says, you know, why is one not working? Why is one free, one a fiscal note? I think we explained it's not quite the same thing. But the main thing is the idea of being able to get savings without laying out money, isn't that, and being innovative, I think that we could all agree. And we applaud you for doing this type of thing. This is good. We'd like to be a part of this.
Senator Perry.
I've been in and out, but if nobody's made the motion to move the bill, I would.
Senator Perry, I think I did initially. I'll withdraw that motion since I'm presiding, and Senator Perry now moves.
I'd move Senate File 907 be recommended to pass and sent to general orders. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Senator Perry moves that Senate File 907 as amended.
You don't have to say that.
Be recommended to pass and sent to the floor be placed on general orders. Is there any discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Senator Zavenda is sent to the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, members. There's no other business before us. We will adjourn in Monday after session. So just listen for the announcement from the chair. We are adjourned.
Meeting tomorrow, huh?
What's that? Not tomorrow.